MK2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. At this time, we begin the second night on line mark, and this will be text net number 1382 of the series that began 29 years ago in September of 1982 is when the text net began. I guess I reason to believe this may be one of the longest running kinds of nets under one particular leadership, and it also has an unusual number of total hours of recorded material that you can play back. The major purpose of the TechNet is education. We amateurs want to know, how does our equipment work and how to make it work better? How does the radio work and the transmitter work? And what's the right way to ground that antenna for lightning and for radio purposes? What is propagation like? There's 26 different kinds of ham radio identified by the CEO of ARRL. 26 kinds, and the one you're listening to right now, 2-meter FM ham radio, is just one of the 26. So if for some reason it doesn't please you, before you give up this very educational hobby, consider one of the other 25. Let me drop. We're going to make an attempt to occasionally let the machine drop long enough so that people who want to sign in by way of IRLP and Echolink have a chance to do that. In the very beginning, when those modes were established on this net, there were a good number of check-ins, and I think those who were using those modes then became a bit frustrated, because as we get enthusiastic and start talking on top of each other and not leaving the right gap between conversations, not listening for all four beeps, the Echolink will time out and the IRLP will time out, and therefore the person from a remote area signing in by those modes gets excluded, and they eventually became frustrated, and not as many check in. So we're going to make a slim attempt to correct that. A person signs into the technical net by giving us your call letters and your name and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not check in, just to let us know that you're listening. In the very beginning, 20-some-odd years ago, we used to do that, and you have a very long list of people saying that I'm listening. Well, by now, after 29 years, we sort of accept the fact that somebody is listening, or it wouldn't exist as long. And that was just a taking up time that was not really part of the educational process, the main purpose of the TechNet. Education is the main purpose. A little bit of humor sometimes squeezes in. We also carry subjects, conduct conversations on subjects that are not necessarily all just how does the hardware work. Sometimes we get into the philosophy of ham radio and the regulation procedures, the FCC requirements and things like that. The TechNet is appropriate for asking questions and making comments on essentially any subject of interest to ham radio operators. And that's a pretty wide field. I've often said that inside of each true ham radio operator, there is a scientist trying to get out or trying to find out how things work. What is Mother Nature really telling him? If there's some time later on, I'll read you a definition by the American Association of Advancement of Science as what is science. They had an editorial once where they described what is science, what is engineering, and what is technology. And although it's a little bit lengthy, you'll soon discover that the definition of science is so wide-ranging, so all-encompassing, that just about everything ham radio operators do really is science. I mean, when a ham radio operator suddenly discovered that some kind of very long propagation was occurring in the summertime, late May, early June, and eventually got recognized as sporadic E propagation over distances like 1,500 miles, when at a VHF frequency, 300 or 400 miles would be sort of the maximum, even on sideband, maybe 100 miles on FM. And you start talking to somebody on all of those modes at 1,500 miles, and you say, gee, something funny is going on here. And an investigation began. Mel Wilson, a man who lives in the Rochester area of New York, began that investigation, and then the Central States VHF Society eventually established an award in his honor. He's now a silent key. So that was a real scientist, a ham radio operator. Gives you a little bit of an idea of what we're talking about. Let me drop. So if there's a little bit of time later on after we do the normal, let me drop. The schedule, we take check-ins in the beginning. We make a sincere effort that everybody who checks in gets at least a brief answer during the first hour or hour and a half. That's going to be followed by Paul, KC2WGB. Here we go, John, KC2WGB, will be reading us the emails that he has received. See, the majority of what the TechNet does is to do a live, on-the-air, real-time question and answer of questions that ham radio operators have. The TechNet in general is not promised to be a written consulting service. However, for the new amateurs who don't yet have a license, don't have a way of checking in and asking their questions live, they do it by way of internet, by checking into, by either emailing directly John, KC2WGB, or there's a place on the, trying to think of the name of it right now. Yeah, but what's the name of the actual section they have to go to? I mean, John, why don't you take that right now? What's the name of the section they have to go to where they can ask, where they can post their questions? Over to you, John.
I believe Lou is listening. He would probably know. I believe it's technet@linemark.com.
So, eventually they're going to be establishing a specific... When you go to linemark.org, and their main webpage, it's got a zillion things to select, but one of those things will eventually become more clear as a place where you post your TechNet questions. Up till now, I think people have been sending the questions directly to John. So after John gives us some of the questions that he's received for the last week, then Paul, WS2N, will be telling us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing recently. And they've got some exciting things going on. Okay, at this time, we're going to take check-ins. Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. K2RIW, TechNet, we're listening.
N2EL, Rich and Yes, Tech.
We got Rich. Who's next one?
K2BHY, yes.
Give me that one again. K2 Baker Hotel Yankee, I think it's more to it. And is that you, Jim? Give me your first call, your full call letters there, Jim.
Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Hotel Yankee, yep.
Yeah, wherever you're... I think you're operating with a handy-talkie, and as you move around, you sometimes go into phase into the machine. That's how I was missing some of your call letters. Okay, we've got Rich and Jim. Who else would like to check in? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment.
WS2N Paul with the space report, and no questions yet. Maybe later there.
Glad to hear we got a space report, Paul. Okay. And you're allowed to have a question. All right, one more call. Anyone with a question or a comment, give me your call letters right now and name.
K2LDY. Name is Don.
Okay, we got you, Don. And we're going to leave a nice long gap just in case someone wants to check in by way of Echolink or IRLP. Any other check-ins, give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we've got three, and that's enough to begin with. And I guess the rest of you guys are watching football games. Rich, N2EO, what's going on in Whitestone? K2RIW.
Okay, good evening, Dick, N2EO. Dick, I have a question as far as interfacing my Down East Microwave 432 and 1296 megahertz transverters to a rig I'm now using. I have an OEcraft K2 that I had put together a few years ago, and it has transverter output jacks. The transverters are set up to drive on 10 meters up to 430, convert to 432 with 1296. The way they're set up, they have a pot in there that you can adjust, so you could drive it anywhere between 1 milliwatt of drive on 10 meters and 250 milliwatts. Let me go to recycle. The problem I'm running into, Dick, I've got just about a milliwatt coming out. So the pot is all the way open, and I'm getting just, you know, about less than half power out. So what I have to do is build a small external amplifier to go output of the transverter out jack and the input to the transverters. Now, I just wanted to get a recommendation from you. If you're familiar with a transistor, a 2M5109 or a 2M5179, they're low-power devices. I've used them in the past, not in this manner, in other circuits, so I'm somewhat familiar with them. You may want, I've got them up on the Internet right now. 2N5109, 2N5179. They're what they call epitaxial planar transistors. You might give me a definition of an epitaxial planar transistor. I'm wondering, my question is as far as matching. Let me get a reset. What I plan to do is use a small Pomona box. If you remember the old W1JR preamps for 432 in the 1970s, I'm sure you do. I want to use that type of construction where I build the thing on a PC board ground plane, point-to-point connections. It shouldn't be very difficult to do. My question is, can I go in broadband on 10 meters? What I'm worried about is generating spurious emissions coming out on 10 meters and putting a spur out on 432 or 1296. So if I use a tuned circuit, I can like tap down a coil, I could use an L network going in, an L network going out, a T network. I'm not exactly sure how to attack the problem. I need about 10 to 13 dB of gain. So I'll take that 1 milliwatt and bring it up to 10 milliwatts or 20 milliwatts. So that would be 10 to 13 dB again, and that would do me just fine. By the way, Dick, I was listening. I didn't make any contacts in the VHF-UHF contest, but I want to let you know 432 and 2 meters and 6 meters were very, very busy. I did hear some stuff on 1296. I heard K1PXE working Doug in New Jersey, K3LTM on 1296. I heard some CW signals on 1296. 432 I'm receiving very well. Stuff was 20/30/9 from Pennsylvania. Same ditto for 2 and 6. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet Weimark, N2EO.
I need a little bit of a correction, Rich. One of the things that you said was that your Elecraft has a transverter output 10-meter port, which is intended for feeding transverters. You said there's a potentiometer there which you can adjust the power output between 1 and 250 milliwatts. And you said when the pot is all the way out, which means a minimum signal, I guess you meant, and you're only getting 1 milliwatt, the 1 milliwatt only drives your transverter to half power. I'm wondering why you're not turning up the power out of that driver port. If it's capable of going as high as 250 milliwatts, and that should be more than enough for most transverters, I'm wondering why an intermediate amplifier is required when you have a potentiometer you can use. I'm missing something there, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Yes, you are. The transverter can take, depending how the pot is adjusted, in the transverter, as low as 1 milliwatt, as high as 250 milliwatts. The radio is only putting out 1 milliwatt. So I'm at the low end.
When you read the instruction manual for the Elecraft, does it say it can only put out 1 milliwatt? Is there any way that the Elecraft itself, with all of its internal controls and external controls, can the Elecraft put out more than a milliwatt? I'm a little bit confused. So darn many guys are using the Elecraft very successful with Down East microwaves. They've solved the problem. They didn't put in an intermediate amplifier. And by the way, I've got a much better suggestion for the intermediate amplifier. But before we go there, are you sure that the Elecraft, when you read its manual, doesn't have a way of putting out up to, let's say, 10 milliwatts? Over to you, Rich.
Actually, if you go, you can go into the low power or high power mode. It's an interfacing problem, Dick. And the high power mode, it'll go 1 watt, I think it'll go like 1 watt to 10 watts, or maybe less than a watt. But now you're coming out of the regular jack, not out of the transverter output jack. The transverter output jack will only put out about a milliwatt. So if you go into the high power transvert mode, you're coming out of the main jack, and if I make a mistake and go to transmit, say, some other band, there's a possibility of putting, you know, watts into the transverter and doing damage. If it's another way, Down East Microwave has a chip, I'm not sure what a mimic is, they call it a mimic, that can be put in the transverter to give you an extra 10 dB, so you go from 0.01 to 1 milliwatt, but I really rather avoid that.
As you add the preamplifier that you're thinking of adding, Rich, there's another problem, and that is the transverter output port, if there's only one, which is doing both transmitting and receiving.
Nope, two ports, Dick, one for transmit, one for receive.
Okay, you've already anticipated that one. Glad to hear that. When you look at the schematic diagram of the 1 milliwatt output for the transmit function transverter port of your Elecraft, where is that 1 milliwatt coming from? Is it a voltage divider network? Is it a tapped coil? What is that? Because since the transmitter has the ability to put out 10 watts, somewhere in one of its intermediate stages, the power you're looking for does exist. And I'll bet you somebody, if you do enough searching of the internet articles on the Elecraft, among the serious guys on VHF, UHF frequencies, that Elecraft is a very popular rig, and it has fired up an awful lot of Down East Microwaves transverters. So I think within the Elecraft itself, there may be a direct approach of increasing that power output. So when you look at the schematic, where is that 1 milliwatt coming from in the transmit mode, and is there a way of tapping into more of it, of the Elecraft itself? Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I'm really not sure. It's an option that I put in the transverter module, and it's all under firmware software control, so I'm not really sure. You have to put it into, you dial up a menu, and then you dial up how much you want out using the main tuning knob. How they're doing it, I'm really not sure, but I've got it at maximum now, which it actually says the maximum is 1.25 milliwatt, and it's driving the transverter to about a third output.
Now, I think you said you want to drive a Down East Microwave both on 432 and 1296. Are you getting the exact same problem on both transverters, Rich? In other words, no matter which transverter you're feeding, both of them are only giving you one-third output. Over to you, Rich.
I'm using a coax switch to go between the common port on the transverter switch, either the 432 or the 1296. Either position, both are approximately the same output. About 20 watts out. The transverters are good for 50 watts on 432 and 1296. About 18, 20 watts out.
The Down East Microwave transverter has a specification for drive requirement. What does it say in milliwatts or dBm that it needs for proper drive, Rich? Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, what I said before, yeah, it can be configured from the factory in different ways. It right now is configured between 1 milliwatt and 250 milliwatts, depending how you set a level control. It's an adjustable pad inside the transverter. So the minimum is 1 milliwatt, the maximum is 250. It can be converted to drive between I think it's 0.1 milliwatt, and I forget, an extra 10 dB with a mimic chip. I'm not sure exactly what a mimic is, but I want to try and avoid modifying it because I may want to use it on some other equipment in the future that doesn't require such a small amount of drive.
Okay, Down East Microwave is a pretty well-respected company here, Rich. They make a product that a lot of hams have bought, and they're happy with it. If they claim that it can, without an input potentiometer to the transverter in the form that you bought it, that it can operate between 1 and 250 milliwatts, but it can operate on 1.0 milliwatts, and your Elecraft is claimed to be putting out 1.25 milliwatts, it sounds like they should be compatible. Is there any possibility that the particular piece of cable you used from the Elecraft through the relay over to the down east microwave transverter, that there's extra loss in there that you didn't know about? Have you taken your watt meter, your power meter, and put it at the tail end of that cable just before it goes into the transverter and confirm what power output you're really getting? If, for instance, you measure 0.75 milliwatt there and you make the measurement right at the output of the Elecraft and you measure 1.5 milliwatts, you can see where I'm going on this one. I wonder if you've done a confirmation that there could be an excessive insertion loss that you didn't know about. I mean, that a very good-looking, mechanical-looking piece of cable really have some water in it or something else funny going on that has got some extra loss. Have you done any measurement to confirm what your drive power at the far end of the cable versus the near end of the cable, what it really is? Over to you, Rich. Let's keep it simple, in other words. I'm going to give you some other suggestions downrange, but let's see if we can keep it simple. N2EO, K2RIW.
Pretty certain the cables are okay. They're good. I forget the numbers. RG-188. Forget the mill number on it. It's Teflon silver plated, double shielded. I used that because I didn't want to have a leakage on the 10 meter band in or out. Everything is done with BNCs. So to me, they're known good cables, Dick.
Okay, RG-188 is a fairly small diameter cable. Although I'll admit at 10 meters, it shouldn't have a lot of loss. Do you have a power meter where you can really measure the amount of power arriving at the far end of that cable versus the near end of the cable? That's question number one. Question number two, how many feet of RG-188 are you using? Over to you, Rich.
I may have the wrong number. This is the same diameter as RG-58. It's a mill cable. It's all silver plated. It's a mill cable. It's done with BNCs. There's only a couple of feet of it. So I may have the wrong number. I don't remember the number of this stuff. It's double shielded, silver plated, Teflon.
Okay. Do you have the ability to measure power output, Rich? Go ahead.
And Dick, I don't have a meter that'll go that low. What I do have is an RF voltmeter that I can put across a 50-ohm load and use P equals E squared over R.
You got it. With a 50-ohm load on a BNC T connector, where the one end of the T is the cable in, one end of the T is the cable going out to the dummy load, and the junction between the two goes over to your millivolt meter. And you got to worry a little bit about the volts that you're reading. Are they RMS or peak? But you know the mathematics of that. And 1 watt is 10 volts. I think it is peak. 1 milliwatt. 1 milliwatt, I know it on a 600 ohm line. It's roughly a quarter of a volt RMS on a 600 ohm line. We'll figure that one out. I would confirm that first, Rich. Is the Elecraft really putting out the power it's supposed to at the far end of the cable? Even though the cable looks beautiful, are you getting that amount of power at the right at the back panel of the Elecraft after the cable? By the way, double shielded RG-58 size cable is often called RG-223. That's the double shielded, silver plated, although I'll admit that one's got polyethylene. It's not Teflon. Okay. You're probably right on the cable you're talking about. But I would measure the power first, Rich, and find out if there's something funny going on with your relay, the cable, before you get elaborate. Then when you do get elaborate, if you're positive you really need a preamplifier, rather than picking up a 2N5109 or 5179, there's a much easier approach, and that is the three-terminal amplifying devices sold by Mini Circuits, among many other people, right there in Brooklyn, very close to where you live. Not too close, but you know what I mean. Let me drop. You go to the Mini Circuits catalog, and they have a whole series of three-terminal amplifying devices. The beauty of these things is that choose the right one, and They go to almost any frequency range you want, Jeff. Anywhere from 1 megacycle to 5 gigahertz. And the various versions have different amounts of gain, different amounts of power output. But as a three terminal device with a known 50 ohms input and a known 50 ohms output, you ground one of those leads. One of the leads is the input lead, and you just connect the signal to it. The output lead, you put a properly chosen resistor up to a power supply, like plus 5 volts or plus 10 volts. Just choose the right resistor so that the whole thing draws the right current. And that's the whole circuit. 50 ohms in, 50 ohms out, the gain that you want, the frequency range that you want. And as long as you've chosen one that's high enough in power output, if you choose one, for instance, that's good for plus 15 dBm, plus 17 dBm, you know, 50 milliwatts of capability, and you're only asking for a couple of milliwatts out of it, you'll be cranking it back so far, so to speak, that, and by the way, there's another thing to worry about. Can you lower the power output of the Elecraft so you don't overdrive the little three-terminal amplifier? But anyhow, you'll be cranking it back so far, you'll be using so little of its power output that it won't be making any harmonics. The harmonics coming out of the amplifier will be 40 dB down. And you can always add a filter on the output if you think that's a problem, a simple LC filter. But that's a much easier approach. So as I see it, Rich, let me drop. I would use whatever power meters you've got. The millivolt meter is a good one. Confirm that you really got the drive power you're supposed to get. And there still is a disconnect, because I know darn well that there's some extra margin built into the Downeast microwave. If he says he needs a milliwatt, I guarantee that most of them will work at 0.9 milliwatt. And your Elecraft is supposed to be putting out 1.25. So there's a disconnect here. Double confirm power. Then if you're absolutely positive you've got to build an amplifier, consider using those three-terminal devices. Lots of guys on the VHF frequencies have used them. They have almost no complaints. There's a zillion different brand names and model numbers and whatever. But Mini Circuits is one of the first places to start off with. Now you don't have to worry about properly setting the bias, properly setting the stability, worrying about feedback. All of that's taken care of in this tiny little package. I wonder if you've ever seen any of these, Rich. And by the way, as you make these measurements and as you do these confirmations and move downrange, let us know how this project is going. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good. K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, N2EO. That's good to know. This way I don't have to start playing around with discrete components. What is the, do you happen to know the series number on those? I'm going to look them up on the internet. Or you go on to the next happy customer. I know, for instance, the mixers, they got the SRA series, the SBL series. Do you know what I should look for, Dick?
I wish I did, and somebody's going to sign in and tell us. But there's a whole series of these little three-terminal devices. You do have to use a coupling capacitor on the input so that the input terminal is able to set its own bias. A simple dis-ceramic coupling capacitor on the input, a simple resistor and a coupling capacitor on the output, and that little chip, you mount it on a piece of vector board or whatever, or a piece of printed circuit board, put it in a box, and you got it made. In fact, I don't think you've got to put it into the box. I think you can locate it either in the Elecraft itself or in the Downeast microwave. That's your choice as to where you put it, which one you want to modify. But I don't think you need a separate box for this thing. It's so darn simple. I guarantee that somewhere within the Elecraft, the power supply you need to feed this thing is already there. And as I said, these little three-terminal amplifiers, you can feed them on anything from about 5 volts up to about 25 volts. You just choose that the resistor that goes to the output terminal, the collector, so to speak. You choose the right resistor so that with your power supply, it draws the right amount of current. And then after that, everything is hunky-dory. It works like a charm. So, does anybody know the model number of the three-terminal amplifiers from Mini Circuits? Give me your call letters right now, K2LAW.
All right, Jake, I guess nobody knows out there. That's... What I'll do is I'll call Mini Circuit Labs. Will they sell, do I have to go to a Mini Circuit Lab distributor, do you know, or if I call them in Brooklyn, maybe I can just ask for an engineering sample, I don't know.
When it comes to selecting it, go to the website, Mini Circuits has a very nice website showing all of their products, and they've got a zillion products. So go to the website. There you'll select the exact product you want. I suspect there's a good chance you can talk them into sending you an engineering sample. But even if you've got to buy it outright, I think the thing is like a dollar and a half rich. And guarantee there are vendors selling them that are already on the shelf. I think there's a good chance you can get it from Mini Circuits directly. I think they're a little bit like... I can't think of the name of that other catalog that everybody uses. What can I use? Think of the name of the catalog everybody uses where they buy parts and you don't have to buy a minimum order.
DigiKey.
That's the one, DigiKey. It's probably in the DigiKey catalog, among other places. So go to the Mini Circuits website to select the one you want, Rich. And that way you'll be three steps ahead before you call them. And I think DigiKey has probably got it on the shelf, if you know what I mean. So getting that part and finding the right one is not going to be easy, not going to be very difficult for a guy like you. Okay, we're going to go on to the next person, which was Jim. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee. Go right ahead, Jim. K2RIW, the TechNet.
All right, well, I have two questions. One is, well, first of all, I switched to my 2-meter 440 beam antenna that I bought a couple weeks ago, but didn't come with the feed line, so I had to go to the Radio Shack, and it wasn't there, so I had to order it. But anyway, first of all, I was on here, I was on this repeater, and from JD, I think K2ADD, I believe, I'm not sure, but from JD, he told me that on 145.670, there's a repeater that I believe is connected by Echolink to a repeater in Ireland. And I tried it out, and I got someone in the UK, the Republic of Slovakia, Ireland. And I was just wondering if you knew how that worked, or if you knew anything about that repeater. Back to you.
I'm not a pro on this. I'm going to tell you what I know, and as I make mistakes, people will correct me. A significant number of the modern repeaters, this is one of them, have various modes of Echolink capability. Echolink, if I understand it correctly, is a method by which once you dial the repeater into the right mode, it is taking the audio output from its receiver at the repeater site, plugging it into a internet audio technique, IRLP-like thing. It gets connected, because of the way you selected the connection, to a similar repeater in, let's say, for instance, the United Kingdom. That repeater in the United Kingdom takes that audio off of the internet, reconverts it back into its digital audio, reconverts it back into analog audio, and plugs it into that transmitter so that it comes out of that repeater transmitter. Therefore, a person using Echolink can be talking into a repeater in New York State. His audio comes out of a repeater in, let's say, Ireland. The person in Ireland is hearing the audio as if you were in Ireland, going through the repeater in a normal manner. And also, quite often, sometimes, a person in Ireland with his handy talkie in his hand could join in on the conversation, sometimes simultaneously, but usually it's done by simplex. In other words, you'll have a round table of three guys. The guy that's listening to the output of the repeater, and maybe another guy on the input, and the guy that you're talking to, and so on. So it's an internet connection. You got to be a little bit careful on the timing of all of this. Let me drop. When you're using Echolink or IRLP, you have to make sure that you drop for a long enough period of time, wait for the right beeps and so on, so that everything can reset, because every repeater has a timeout timer, so that if, for instance, a dead carrier was placed on this repeater for the next 24 hours and the transmitter would go on for 24 hours, there's a timer to stop that from happening after 1, 2, or 3 minutes. Second of all, the internet connection itself has a timeout timer. There's got to be a delay in the conversation every couple of minutes with it. And the repeater you're talking to in the United Kingdom has a timer. So you have to make sure that in between your conversations, and you got to make sure that your conversations are not too long-winded. You talk for 4 solid minutes on any of these links, and you're going to be in trouble. The last 2.5 minutes, they're not going to hear, if you know what I mean. So you have to make sure you interrupt periodically And on those interruptions, you have to make sure you interrupt for a long enough period of time so that all of that hardware gets properly reset. But that's a thumbnail sketch of my understanding of Echolink. When I pass it back to you, Jim, drag your feet a little bit, give a little bit of a delay in case other people with Echolink smarter than me will give you some more information. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee, with a little bit of delay, K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like nobody protested, Jim, so I must have been somewhat correct. You got it, Jim.
All right, thanks. JD told me about it, and I was working some people, you know, in Ireland, the UK. But then the next day I tried to work it, and there wasn't... I was monitoring, and I couldn't get a response, and I even went as far as interrupting a conversation, and I didn't get a response. I had the PL tone and everything, but, you know, I don't know. Back to you.
Yeah, I've got some guesses. Every so often you'll hear somebody coming through on Echolink or IRLP on this repeater. He gives a call saying, is anybody there in New York State that can talk to me? And sometimes there's no answer. There's just nobody there that's available at that time. That's one possible answer. Even though you interrupted a conversation, the people were having a pretty tight conversation between people that know each other very well. They thought that the extra conversation from Jim was something that they were supposed to ignore because they didn't realize what was really going on. That's a guess as to what could be happening. There's also a possibility that your audio wasn't coming through. I know that the people who have tried to check into the TechNet by way of Echolink and IRLP, the few that I've talked to, end up reasonably frustrated. Frustrated because all of those resettings, there's three different places where resetting takes place. Your local repeater, the internet connection, and the file repeater. Each has a timeout timer. And in the case of the TechNet, where people get very enthusiastic about their particular conversation, don't wait long enough for all four beeps, and therefore timeout occurs. Therefore, the person in the remote location, because of the dropout, he now is only hearing, you know, half of the TechNet with great big gaps in between where he's not hearing it. He gets frustrated and gives up. So Echolink is good and bad. It's not ideal. This particular repeater right now, for instance, the linking that takes place between the East Coast, here we go, the Eastern Long Island input on 147.375 and the Western Long Island 146.85, that is an internet connection. Let me drop. And from day to day, that particular internet connection has different amounts of latency, different amounts of delay. Sometimes the delay is an eighth of a second, sometimes it's 3 seconds. Sometimes the audio is very loud, sometimes the audio is very soft. There's a variability there going on, which some people are a little bit frustrated with. This repeater group is in the process of forming a radio link between the two, which will not require the internet connection, and therefore some of that difficulty will be disappearing in the near future. So internet connection, when you're going from a long distance, like 1,000 miles, like an internet connection by way of Echolink between New York and Florida, to go through the internet is very appropriate. When we've got two repeaters that are only, let me pick a number, 30 miles apart, that really should be a radio link, not an internet link, because the internet link has got these other difficulties, if you know what I mean, Jim. KD2, BHY, K2RIW.
All right, thanks. I'm trying to do all the DX thing I can without my general, but hopefully I'll have that soon, and I'll get, you know, maybe an HF rig. But I have another quick question. Don't make this one too long, because I'm taking up quite a bit of time bandwidth here. Do you know any satellite software? Because I have this new beam antenna, and I don't know where the satellites are. Back to you.
Thank you. real satellite people, the ham radio satellite people, why am I having trouble thinking of their name, AMSAT. If you go to the AMSAT website, because they really want people to be using the amateur satellites, AMSAT.com or NSAT.org, whichever it is, they've got a monthly journal, and they've got the software you're looking for, and I'm almost positive they supply it free of charge. They'll give you the update coordinates to go into it. What are they called now? The numbers that you put in for right ascension of ascending node and apogee and perigee and all this kind of jazz and epoch time. All the numbers that you put into the program and the program itself, if you go to AMSAT.org, I think you're going to get the, you're going to be going to the horse's mouth, if you know what I mean, Jim. You're going to be getting the program from the organization that is most enthusiastic about those particular satellites. That group of people have generated those satellites, the American version of them, and they are also well connected with the AMSAT Germany and AMSAT New England and so on. So I would go there first. Guarantee you're going to find what you want on their particular website. I wonder if anyone's got any further comments on this one. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
N2HDR.
Okay. N2HVR. Start up your name, sir, and your information with reference to AMSAT. My name is Dick.
Hello, Dick. This is N2HVR. My name is Nick. I've been listening to you for, 25 years. I haven't spoken to you in a long time, but anyway. AMSAT.org is the website, and I just wanted to ask Jim, I believe he was at the HRO, Ham University. What do you want to put the software on, a phone or a computer? Because I've been an AMSAT member for 25 years. I have tracking software on my Android phone, which I'm using right now to get on Echolink, on my iPod, iPad. I have SAT, there's a SAT32. There's also free software if you go to HRO.com. There's some free software offered. I have it on a laptop. It just depends on what you want to put the software on. Back to Ned. This is N2HVR.
Awful glad you gave us the information, Nick. Go ahead, Jim. Tell him whether or not it's going on your portable device or on your desktop computer. You got it, Jim.
No, it's on my PC in my shack here. By the way, I just kind of like a little advertisement, but go check out my QRZ page. I just wrote the biography. It's a pretty interesting story of how I became a ham. Back to Matt.
Okay, that's the second interesting website. Jim's, KD2DHY, at QRZ.com. And if you also look at KC2WGB at QRZ.com, you'll see some beautiful pictures of his tiny little laboratory. I'm joking. He's got a garage full of equipment that is his laboratory. Three layers high, three shelves high on three walls, if I sense the photographs correctly. Alrighty, let us know, Jim, as you find that software. Hopefully AMSAT and the other site will get it to you, and we install it with the right numbers that you plug in, the coordinates. What is it called? Hey, Nick, when you put in all of the information for running the program, why can't I think what it's called? Not coordinates. What's the right word for that one, Nick? Over to you, Nick.
This is Jim. I believe it's a grid square. Sorry, I took your place, Nick.
I'm also hearing WZ2U. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I believe you're looking for the term Keplerian element.
That's the right word for it, Keplerian element. Okay. Good old Kepler is one of the first guys who really figured out what central force motion is like. In other words, the way a satellite or a moon goes around a planet or a planet goes around the sun, the Keplerian elements of things like right ascension of ascending node, argument of perigee, epoch time, period, and so on. You put all those numbers into the program, and if the program is a good one for a significant period of time forward, it'll tell you where that satellite's going to be, what azimuth and elevation, or what, how you aim your antenna in order to track that particular satellite. Depending on how well equipped you are, some of these programs will feed another program, where that other program directly commands your rotator, your positioner for the antenna, so that the antenna automatically tracks. Not many guys go that far downrange. WV2U, I wonder, have you gone that far downrange where you have automatic tracking? Give us some words on that one. Go ahead.
W2RIW, WV2U. No, Dick, I have not gone quite that far. But I do use one of the MSAT tracking programs, and it gets a little hectic on hand, changing the heading of the rotor and all, but oh well, it's part of the fun.
Paul, your signal is a little bit noisy into the repeater. I'm hearing you very well with earphones, but some of the other people might have a little trouble hearing you. So if you can aim a little more antenna or a little more power at the repeater. You've used the satellite for how long, Paul? Which program are you using? And how much satellite work have you done? Give us a couple of words on that one, Paul. Paul lives in Seaford. WV2U, K2RIW.
Okay, I moved a little bit. Is that any better, Dick? WV2U?
That's pretty good. So go ahead and continue, Paul.
Yeah, I'm using a program called PCSAT, which is a real, very convenient program. It automatically downloads the Keplerian elements for you automatically, and you can set up, all of your Doppler shifts and all, and add new satellites to it with a well-defined procedure. So, it's a pretty effective program, and it does give you...
You ended very abruptly there, Paul. So you were telling us about the PCSAT program, which automatically downloads the Keplerian elements. You don't even have to worry about putting in these eight-digit numbers, and there's about six of them, the Keplerian elements. And so the fact that that all does automatically sounds pretty nice. You did, as I said, end abruptly, and your signal is still a little bit noisy. I wonder how many watts you're running into, what kind of an antenna. Seaford should have an awful good path to the repeater, so I'm a bit confused. Now, with the extra snow on the antenna and maybe the extra static of the wind blowing by the antenna tonight on a very dry winter night, maybe these are some of the aggravating factors that people are running into. I know that the guys out east were having trouble getting into the repeater today. Their signals were noisier than normal, so there is a change in conditions. WV2U for any other information. K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe Paul's battery suddenly went dead. That's why he suddenly dropped out as a guest. Okay. Go ahead. Who is that?
KTJ. Am I noisy?
You're sounding good there, Eric. Go ahead.
As long as you're on the subject, for the last 20-odd years, I've been using an AMSAT program called Instatrack and a hardware board called the Kansas City Tracker. And the combination of the two, not only does it download the captions and keeps you up to date, it also tunes the receiver for a given satellite and tunes the receiver Doppler-wise, too, as the pass comes overhead, and controls the antenna. And it's an old program, but it still works fine. K2RWK3DX.
Very fine, Eric. Sounds like you're very happy with Instatrack. And you've got some pretty heavy audio there tonight. Just a little bit. You're 2 dB higher than you should be. Not to worry. Where did you get your copy of Instatrack? And even though it's an old program, is it still available, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I bought it from AMSAT years and years ago, and I don't think that, actually I'll look it up in a second, but they have current programs that run on Mac and PC. They also have a hardware interface that will handle your receiver and also handle your AZL rotator, so
you know, if you go to amsat.org, you'll find everything that you need, and the price isn't really not that bad.
Very fine, Eric. Good information. I suggest that you go down 2 dB in audio, and you went down 8 dB. Too much. Alrighty. Good information. We'll go on to the next person now. That was Don. N2LDY, K2LIW. Go right ahead, Don.
Oh, good evening. This is Don, N2LDY. Now, in the beginning, you said that we could talk about things that our hands are interested in. Is that correct?
I said those words, Don, and you can challenge me. Anything that a ham radio operator is interested in, which occasionally is blondes, brunettes, and redheads, but go right ahead. Almost no question that's not going to insult somebody is appropriate. Don, not to worry. And you could speak a little bit louder if you wanted to. Into LDY, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay. Now,
you
said I had overheard a conversation, it's probably 2 weeks ago now, and there were a bunch of hams on here, and they were complaining about the red light cameras and how they thought that the timing on the yellow light was decreased on the intersections where there were red light cameras. And so they were swearing to the fact that that was true. So that sparked my curiosity, and I have a high-speed Casio camera. So during the past couple of weeks when I've been out running around, I've stopped and taken some video on a bunch of different intersections with and without, and I took it at 240 frames per second. Let me reset. And, you know, I went home and I took out all of the frames from when it changed to green and when it changed from yellow to red, and then I counted the all the yellow light frames, and I converted it into time. And to my surprise, I should say, it turns out that all of the red light cameras that I took were actually slightly longer in duration than the regular intersections. So, like, intersections along Middle Country Road were, without the lights, were an average of 3.9, 4.0, 3.8 seconds. The intersections with the red light cameras were averaging 4.3, 4.37, and it was the same on 347. It was slightly longer, because maybe they have it timed slightly different because the cars are going faster there. But it was the same thing. The red light camera intersections stayed on longer, a longer duration than the normal one.
Hey, Don, well done. The way you described what you did, I don't care what anybody says, you are a scientist. You took a known piece of instrumentation, your camera, running 240 frames per second, and really timed these things. And, a person could know that the flashing camera is there, and not all the flashing cameras, by the way, are live. There's a limited number of dollars, so some of the cameras they've installed are really not live, and some of them are live, and they switch around which ones are and are not. There's a whole controversy going on there, but the amount of time that the camera, that the traffic light is in yellow before it turns red is a very important time, because the guys that are running into what they think is a problem, they've got a gut feel, but they didn't really make a measurement. I mean, you can easily get a feeling for something saying that, hey, this is not fair, the yellow is not long enough. Until somebody really makes a quantitative measurement, you don't know. But the quantitative measurement, you've done the first three or four steps of a beautiful system here, Don. Let me tell you what I've got in mind. The next thing to go with your data, not only did you confirm that the ones with the camera are running longer, but the next thing to go with your data is to figure out what is the allowed traffic velocity for that particular area of the road. In other words, if that particular road has a speed limit of 30 miles an hour, there's a certain amount of yellow time that's appropriate. If the road has a speed limit of 50 miles an hour, there's a hell of a lot longer time that the yellow better persist. Let me show you where I'm going here. The Department of Transportation, your Motor Vehicle Bureau, you read their manuals. You read deep enough into their manuals, you find out that a good person, qualified person, has a reaction time of 3/4 of a second. From the time you see a traffic light turn yellow and you decide to do something, when you're prepared ahead of time and you're not distracted by doing something with the radio in the car and talking to people, whatever, if you're really concentrating, you have a minimum of 3/4 of a second of reaction time. A car at 50 miles an hour in 3/4 of a second is going to move something like 50 feet. Once you apply the brakes of the car, if you're not doing a panic stop, there's a reasonable stopping distance and stopping time. And what I worry about is that there are a couple of roads where I know that the road is a 50-mile-an-hour road. The yellow time looks to me kind of short, and if you put it all together, let me drop it. If you put it all together, recognizing the person has to see and analyze the fact that the traffic light just turned from green to yellow, he's then got a reaction time where he decides what he's going to do. He's either so close that he has to go through it. He has no choice. In other words, the intersection is inside of his stopping distance, that if he started stopping immediately, he's going to drift through the traffic light. And therefore, he has essentially no choice. He's got to make a choice. Am I so close that I have to go through, or am I far enough back that I stand a chance to stop? And then he has the 3/4 of a second reaction time in which he makes that decision if he's a really smart guy. He then begins the braking action, and he's now braking for a certain number of seconds and a certain number of feet, and if the traffic light is in the yellow mode for too short a period of time, and if the guy is in the wrong position, he's too close where he can't possibly stop in time, and he's too far, he's too close where he can't possibly stop in time, but the traffic light is so brief that no matter what he does, he's either going to go through it by the time it hits red, or he's going to drift through it with the brakes on, in which case he's entrapped. So is the traffic light appropriate in yellow time compared to the speed limit of that road, knowing normal reaction times? On top of that, on a rainy day, in theory, the stopping distance is even greater, even if you make a panic stop. And should a traffic light force you into a panic stop? So you can see the next level of investigation you could go here, Don. And by the way, when it comes to these traffic lights, you probably do or don't know. Let me drop. That a high percentage of them have an infrared detecting device connected to them so that law enforcement and fire trucks can force a traffic light to be green in their direction. When they're going to an emergency situation, they want to be able to force the traffic light to be green in their direction so that they don't have to wait so that people's lives are not at risk. And it is highly illegal for a human being to own, if you're not part of that organization of law enforcement or ambulance or fire, to own equipment that is capable of false triggering those traffic lights. But the traffic lights can be controlled by an infrared light for emergency situations. Over to you, Don. Great piece of research. N2LDY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I have a question, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
Just out of curiosity, I'm really curious as to what make and model of camera, because I have a Vericam and a couple of other things that will do high speed, but they're in the tens of thousands of dollars. I'm just curious as to what he's using.
Yeah, Don, you did a great piece of research. What kind of a camera did you use? I didn't, but you should wait for all four beeps. Go ahead, Don.
Okay, it's a Casio. I'm not sure of the exact model number, but EX100 or 150 or something like that. Look, you can look it up. It'll do up to 1,000 frames per second. I mainly use it at 420 frames per second, I think, or something like that. Yeah, 420. And I've taking all kinds of video of different things. And it was pretty inexpensive. I think I paid like $250 for it. And I actually have two of them. I have the model just below that one, and that does just as good a job. So I'm extremely happy with the Casio camera that I got, and me being mainly a Canon